Welcome to Politics and Reality Radio. I am your humble host, Joshua Holland. And this week we'll get our wonk on with healthcare economist Austin Fracht, who will tell us all about all payer rate setting, which could offer a different route toward deeper healthcare reforms and better cost control. Then Carolee Coons, the managing editor of Crooks and Liars, will join me to grouse about Donald Trump and how awful everything is. And everything is awful. And finally, speaking of awfulness, we'll be joined by David Dayan, who he wrote a piece for The Intercept this week about a big FU that Congress delivered to the devastated American citizens of Puerto Rico. We've got a lot to cover, so we're going to skip the usual introductory fluff and just jump right in. First, a quick break for an obscure tune by the Kinks that really shouldn't be. Stay tuned, we'll be right back.
Child in the big black smoke, in the big black smoke. Frail as purest girl the world has seen. But your mind, but your mind. And everybody said that she knew no sin or did no wrong until she walked the streets of the big black smoke. Well, she slept in cabs and coffee bars and bowling alleys, and every penny she had was spent on purple hearts and cigarettes. Ah, she took all her pretty colored clothes, ran away from home, or next door.
Welcome back. I'm Joshua Holland, and I'm happy to welcome Austin Fracht to the show. Austin is a health economist at the Department of Veterans Affairs. He's an associate professor at Boston University's School of Public Health and an adjunct associate professor at the Harvard University School of Public Health. He's a man of many affiliations. Professor Fracht, welcome to Politics and Reality Radio.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Thank you for taking the time. And I've written for The Nation about the challenges to passing Medicare for All and the way that it's envisioned in proposals by Bernie Sanders in the Senate, John Conyers in the House. I personally think it's kind of doomed to fail because it compels everyone who has coverage to give that up for something new. And even if we can promise that this new something is better, we run into issues like loss aversion, the tendency for people to lose the idea of losing something that they already have, status quo bias. And also, while a dollar that you're spending to a private insurer is worth the same as a dollar that you might pay in taxes, they're not the same politically. And we're talking about transferring over $1 trillion from the public sector to the private sector. And I love single payer, I love Medicare for All, but I don't think it's possible to pass this. And I'm trying to figure out other alternatives to getting to universal comprehensive coverage, to controlling costs. So I wanted to talk to you about a system that is currently working in Maryland hospitals. Can you tell us what the term au pair means?
Yeah, I'll tell you kind of in broad terms, but there's some variance. So imagine you go into a store like, you know, Target, Walmart, you know, something like that, and you buy something off the shelf, you know, some gum or, you know, some hand towels or whatever, and it's got a sticker price, right? You pay, you know, $1.50 for a pack of gum. And then I go into the same store, I'm going to pay the same price. It's the same product at the same store. Now, hospitals and doctors don't work that way at all. So if I go to a doctor, the price that I pay or my insurer pays may be very different from the price that you would pay or your insurer pays if you're insured by a different company. So right there, you see that the health care market works really differently from the normal consumer market that we're familiar with. Under all payer rate setting, those two markets would work the same way in that if I go to the doctor or the hospital and get an, you know, go to the hospital and get an appendectomy, have my appendix taken out, there's a price for that at this particular hospital. If you go to the same hospital and have the same procedure, you will pay the same price, or your insurer will pay the same price. There will be one price per service for each provider, just like there's one price for a stick of gum at Target or a gallon of milk at, you know, at your local grocery.
Now, I understand that that makes things simpler, but is this a mechanism that can control costs?
Yes. There's various ways that it could. So in Maryland, for example, they have an all-payer rate setting system for hospitals. And actually, go back a few decades, other states had it too. It worked more or less the same way. And that's a system by which a government entity establishes or authorizes prices for each hospital for different services, and that price is paid same for Medicare, same price for Blue Cross Blue Shield, for Aetna, Humana, so on and so forth, all the insurers, and that's a more of a government regulated all payer system. And the way it would reduce spending is if that price is regulated downward from the average price it would be otherwise, right? There are other ways to do it, slightly more complicated. Happy to talk through them, but that right there shows you that it is a mechanism that that could save spending.
Now, in Maryland, this is an administrative all-payer scheme. There's a
right.
a board with seven volunteer commissioners. They're appointed by the governor. No more than three of them can have affiliations with healthcare providers, which is to, I guess, to keep it from ending up being captured by the industry and kind of self-dealing. Are there other models? Can you tell us a little bit about Germany's
exactly,
system?
Yeah.
It's different, right?
Yeah, Germany's different. The way I understand it is that there, all the insurers kind of get together and they negotiate as a group with each hospital or each provider. That's in contrast to the way we do it here in the U.S., where each insurer can negotiate separately with each hospital. And that's precisely why when you go get your appendix out, your insurer might pay one price and my insurer would pay a different price, because they've each negotiated separately for that procedure, how much that'll cost. And Medicare pays a different price, you know. So in Germany, all those groups get together and they negotiate as a unit with each hospital, and they say this is what we'll pay as a unit, no matter who, which insurer is paying. It's all going to be the same price.
And I mean, if I understand this correctly, this is a way of gaining some of the efficiencies of single payer without moving everyone into a single pool, because you know, basically you have the bargaining power of this huge pool of insured people, even though they're being insured by other different actors, right?
Yeah, exactly right. Under single payer, obviously, you would have one price for each hospital and each procedure, because there's only one payer, so there can only be one price. This is a way to have multiple payers, but still have one price and have the bargaining leverage of the single payer, even though you have multiple insurance companies involved.
And I should just note that a study published in Health Affairs found that in Maryland, the cost of hospital admission in 1976, before they enacted the scheme, it was 26% above the national average. So 30 years later, in 2007, the study was published, I think in 2000, 2009, the average hospital cost in Maryland was 2% below the national average. So it had proven effective, at least in this one state, and this is obviously just hospitals, to some degree in terms of controlling costs. Now, let me ask you this. We currently finance about half of our healthcare through the public sector. To what degree do those dollars already bargain collectively with providers? Is it all separate, or do programs like Medicare and Medicaid set rates together?
Medicare and Medicaid do not set rates together, nor do private insurers. There are a lot. We have a very complicated health system, as you know, and there's a lot of nuances to this. So, in some situations, one payer, you know, one insurer or the Medicaid program might key their payment rates off Medicare. They might say, whatever Medicare is paying across all the various services, all the different kinds of surgeries and so forth, whatever they're paying, we'll pay, you know, 85% of that or 122% of that. You know, so they can be linked if the insurer, you know, sort of chooses to negotiate in that way. Or they could be completely different if they choose to go another way. I believe it's the case that most often, out of just convenience, Medicaid just keys off Medicare as a percent. Probably many insurers do too, but some have different kinds of contracts. Things get even or kind of slightly different in the Medicare Advantage market, which are the Medicare Advantage or private plan alternatives to traditional Medicare. I could go through all that, but that kind of operates in a different way due to different regulations. So basically, we have a complex system, and you can find, you know, different entities doing it in different ways.
I am interested in how that works. Can you unpack that a little bit in terms of Medicare Advantage plans?
Right. So just in case your listeners aren't totally familiar, Medicare Advantage plan has to offer the same benefits as the traditional public Medicare program. They can offer enhanced benefits if they want, and many of them do. They're run by private insurance companies, and they have networks. Traditional Medicare doesn't have a network. Any provider who accepts Medicare is automatically kind of in the traditional Medicare program. Medicare Advantage plans can establish a network, and they do that to try to get the lower cost, sometimes higher quality providers in their network. But it means that if you go outside the network, you're technically like not covered by your plan. However, there is a regulation that says if a hospital, say, is not in your Medicare Advantage plan and you go to that hospital for care, that care will be paid for by the Medicare Advantage plan at traditional Medicare prices. So, in other words, Medicare Advantage will pay the same price as the public program for any organization that they don't contract with. They don't have an established like relationship with, they're not directly in the network. And that that actually ends up constraining how much they'll pay for ones that they do have in network, because why should they pay more than for traditional Medicare if they can just exclude the organization and pay the traditional Medicare price? By the same token, why should a hospital, say, accept less than the traditional Medicare price if by saying, no, I don't want to contract with you, they can get that price? You see what I'm saying? So it actually, what you find is that not by any explicit law, but just by this quirk, Medicare Advantage prices end up being very, very close to traditional Medicare prices. It's almost like they're sort of like by nature locked in. It's almost like all payer rate setting, but it's through this kind of backdoor way.
Are there other things we should know about this kind of approach in terms of the advantages or disadvantages? You know, there's, I think on the broad political left, there's this hunger for Medicare for all. It's a bold idea. I think that's part of what makes it attractive to people. It's not kind of fidgeting around the fringes of a really problematic healthcare system. What else should we know?
Well, I mean, I do want to be careful not to conflate Medicare for all with the sort of payment system we were talking about, all payer rate setting.
No, definitely.
There are certainly two different concepts. You can have one and not the other. And also, the other thing to think about Medicare for all, it's become a term that is disconnected from the actual how Medicare actually operates today. So some people use the term, and I think Bernie Sanders uses it, to kind of evoke the traditional Medicare program, the public program.
Yes.
That should be valid. However, as we just talked about, Medicare also has these Medicare Advantage plans as a separate part. And a third of Medicare beneficiaries in those plans, and it's been growing, so it's a sizable program. You know, a true Medicare for all, meaning, you know, let's take Medicare as it is and provide it as it is to everybody, would include all these private options. What it would be actually is like the Affordable Care Act marketplaces with the public option,
right.
being traditional Medicare. And so that's just another way of saying the same thing. So that actually has some appeal because it puts private plans in competition with the public option, and people can choose which they prefer. And maybe some will win out, and some won't. And that's just the market, the way the market operates. And you know, who am I to say which is better? If you like one, go to one. If you like the other, go to the other. There's some sort of appeal to that. As for all payer rate setting, I think the thing to think about there is that if it's the concern about that is one concern is similar to what people are concerned about with a single payer program, which is if it is used to constrain healthcare spending, I'm doing air quotes here, too much, you could harm the innovation advantage that we've seen in the U.S. It is true that the U.S., because of its very large and lucrative healthcare market, has spurred a great deal of healthcare innovation that benefits not just U.S. patients, but patients around the world. There is a real cost to constraining healthcare spending in terms of innovation. Now, that doesn't mean we shouldn't do it. It may be that we're innovating, you know, too quickly. We're paying more than we really want to, and maybe we're innovating in ways that aren't that valuable for patients, and there's some waste there. But I'm just saying it's a completely valid concern that you can constrain spending too much and harm some of the innovation that we may want.
Interesting. And just so listeners know, the Medicare Advantage plans kind of have the playing field tilted towards them in some ways. For example, there's they can put a cap on out-of-pocket costs, whereas traditional Medicare does not. There are other ways to finance that kind of innovation, right? I mean, the idea that this is taking up, it's, you know, 17% of our economic output is spent on healthcare. Dean Baker, for example, at the Center for Economic Policy and Research, has talked a lot about increasing funding for general research as a means of undermining this argument that we need to spend so much in order to innovate. He's written about this in terms of drugs. Is that something that you agree with?
Yeah, absolutely. There's nothing that says that we have to encourage innovation through high healthcare prices. You can have lower healthcare prices and yet have separate programs that encourage innovation, particularly in the pharmaceutical market, through, you know, bonus payments and you know, prizes and things like that. And this has been proposed in lots of different areas. So they are separable. I just want to go back really quickly. Medicare Advantage, there are strengths and limitations to the program. But one thing it actually does do that the traditional program doesn't is provide provide true catastrophic coverage in that traditional Medicare actually, if your spending is high enough, there's a point at which it will actually it won't cap your out-of-pocket spending. You can actually just keep spending forever. There's no like catastrophic point where it just covers everything, and it can actually be very expensive for people. Whereas Medicare Advantage tends to have protections at the high end, which a lot of people, as well as coverage, you know, a lot of coverage for the cost sharing.
And that's attractive for people. I mean,
oh, it's
you know,
very attractive.
To have that kind of, especially if you're on a fixed income, you're, you know, older,
oh, yeah.
You may not have some health problems, et cetera, et cetera. I should add that the Conyers proposal, and I believe the Sanders proposal also, they are for, quote, improved Medicare, and they would do away with the Advantage programs, which I think is also politically really problematic. If you say, oh, yes, by the way, a third of current retirees are going to lose their preferred health care coverage. That seems to me to be kind of a third rail politically.
Oh, definitely. And I mean, another thing to keep in mind is that with traditional Medicare being so highly constrained by Congress in terms of what it can and can't do, and any new benefit that has to be added has to go through legislation, it actually took decades to add a prescription drug benefit, while it was kind of the standard in the private market. And Medicare Advantage plans were offering prescription drug coverage long before it was available as a universal program. So that's another concern about single payer is that you could end up with the program that's kind of just for political reasons hard to innovate.
Austin Fracht, I believe we are out of time. I really want to thank you for taking the time to speak with us. These are really interesting insights into the healthcare system.
It's been great. Thanks for having me.
Folks, stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break and then be right back with Caroli Coons from Crooks and Liars.
Est bourré de vices, à chacun ses délices, à chacun sa 8-6. Dans ma rue, les lascars se serrent la main. Ce n'est pas comme dans le showbiz où les mecs se font la bise. Dans ma rue, les chinois s'entraident et se tiennent par la main. Les youpins s'éclatent et font des magasins. Et tous les lascars fument sur les mêmes joints. Dans ma rue, c'est une pub pour Benetton. Et tout le monde écoute les mêmes sons à fond. Mangeur de cachère ou de saucisson. Dans ma rue, je suis posé. Je marche tranquille dans la ville. J'esquive les civils et reste le patron du style. À chacun sa banlieue, la mienne, je l'aime. Et elle s'appelle le 18e. Il faut être trilingue et faire attention quand on marche sur des seringues. Se méfier des dingues qui sortent leurs flingues. Dans ma rue, les péripatéticiennes craquent pour du crack. Les pompiers les réveillent en leur mettant des claques. Personne ne veut tenter le bouche à bouche. Les clodos s'échappent pour ne pas prendre de douche. Dans ma rue, le vendeur de grec veut nous empoisonner. Sa viande est bizarre, son huile est périmée. Comme moi, l'épicier fait ses courses à ED. Il me revend les mêmes produits que j'achète l'après-midi. 4 ou 5 fois plus cher la nuit. Dans ma rue, ça vole, ça viole. Mais qu'est-ce que tu veux? À chacun sa banlieue. La mienne, je l'aime et elle s'appelle... Chapelle, terminus, tout le monde descend, reste ou prend son bus. Bienvenue dans ma rue, où la crasse colle à tes pieds sur le trottoir comme de la glu. Bienvenue dans ma rue, où les pigeons meurent dans le caniveau, à force de manger du dégueulis de toxico. Dans ma rue, autant de flics que de mecs cocus. Le coiffeur raconte des blagues aux dealers, les policiers donnent des planques aux voleurs. Le facteur aide le macro à relever les compteurs. J'ai été élu président de ma rue, j'ai placé mes ministres, tout le monde est corrompu. À chacun sa banlieue, la mienne, je l'aime, et elle s'appelle le 18e.
Welcome back. I'm still Joshua Holland, and I'm joined now by Caroli Coons. She's the managing editor of Crooks and Liars. Caroli, welcome back to the show.
Well, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for taking the time. You know, this week, just this week, 7 short days, Trump has basically trashed the deal he supposedly made with Democrats to keep the Dreamers from being deported. His climate change denying EPA chief announced that they plan to roll back Obama's clean power regulations. And here I must pause and remind people that Donald Trump believes that clean coal is coal that is actually cleaned. I swear to God.
I know, it's so sad.
Trump signed an executive order which could blow a giant hole in Obamacare and is sabotaging the law in other ways that are already raising premiums and will, during this enrollment period in the Affordable Care Act exchanges, inevitably lead to a decline in coverage. And he's doing this pretty much out of spite. He threatened to pull aid from Puerto Rico. It has been reported that he's very close to killing the international Iran nuclear deal. Am I forgetting anything?
I think you've got.
Oh, he threatened to take the broadcast licenses of.
Oh, right. The broadcast
media companies. Yeah, mm-hmm. It's easy to forget something, leave something out. It's exhausting in a way that I don't recall from any previous administration. George W. Bush was really bad, but, you know, I never had the sense that he was personally unstable. What does that do to a society when you have a president who is this erratic and unpredictable?
Oh, that's a great question. I mean, I think that I'm not sure we even know the extent of the damage it can do to a society, and not just our society, but on a larger level, what the world must be thinking right now. I mean, it feels like we're seeing a breakdown in everything.
Yeah.
It's terrifying. I mean, and today, you know, for all the stories that we've heard about General Kelly being the stabilizing influence and blah, 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 as chief of staff, he came out and did a press conference today where he basically gaslighted us all, you know, and said, hey, nothing to see here. No problems.
Yes.
Everything's, it's all good.
Yeah, folks, we're recording this on Thursday, by the way. So this was last Thursday this happened. I believe that there are things that are hard to measure. There is, I think, a loss of productivity. I have to imagine that, you know, a certain share of the American public is dealing with depression, you know, anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
Things that, and I know that I have been less productive. I know this because I had a fellowship and I had to do a report where I went back and looked back on everything that I'd written for the last 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I've personally, my output has declined since Trump has been in office. I mean, there's plenty to write about, but some days I'll get caught up in whatever controversy, you know, whatever non-troversy he's started, and I just find myself, like, 5 hours have passed, and I've been on Twitter, like, commiserating with people or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a healthy state of affairs. It really isn't.
No, it's not a healthy state of affairs. And on the one hand, you know, I envy the people who can actually just tune out from all of it and say, you know, I'm not even going to think about this. I'm just going to go about the business of the things that are important to me. And I'm jealous of them because, you know, I mean, I get paid for this to be important to me. So I, you know, have to pay attention to it. And at a level that, I'm not sure I could or would if I didn't, you know, I mean, it's stressful. And the thing is I keep telling myself every time he has these meltdowns, every time he makes us that this is part of who he is. I mean, he's just basically an impulsive old dude who should be screaming at the television and not making policy. You know, but he is making policy, and therefore it's got to be more than that. And how do we balance, you know, what weight we give to it and what weight we don't? And then we have these reports that there's just complete breakdowns and meltdowns all over the White House, you know, because of him, that he hates everybody and all the other things that are coming out. And they're coming out from reliable reporters, reporters who don't just make stuff up.
Yes.
There
have been so many reports about his brooding, his brooding, his rages. Yeah. You know, this makes me think, do you remember way back in February, there was this guy, he actually wrote the criteria that define narcissistic personality disorder. Mm-hmm. And he wrote this letter to the editor in the New York Times, and he said, look, Trump does not have narcissistic personality disorder. Hold on one half sec. Let me just, I have this here. All right, I'm gonna read this to you.
Mm-hmm.
He says, he may be a world-class narcissist, but this doesn't make him mentally ill because he does not suffer from the distress and impairment required to diagnose mental disorder. Mr. Trump causes severe distress rather than experiencing it and has been richly rewarded rather than punished for his grandiosity, self-absorption, and lack of empathy. Mm-hmm. And then he says, it is a stigmatizing insult to the mentally ill to be lumped in with Mr. Trump. Now, I am very sensitive about stigmatizing the mentally ill.
Mm-hmm.
But this whole idea that, you know, this guy is president of the United States, he has his fingers on the, you know, nuclear football or whatever.
Yep.
And it's clear from all of these reports that this psychiatrist's opinion was based on, I guess, was based on what he had observed previous to all of these reports, that he's having these regular meltdowns, that he's losing it, that he's, you know, furious and depressed and moody. So he says Mr. Trump causes severe distress rather than experiencing it. Hmm. That's not true, is it?
No, it's not true. And I was raised by a narcissist, and I'm here to tell you right now that I didn't agree with that article when it was written, and I don't agree with it now. I mean, and my father was diagnosed with narcissistic personality disorder, and Trump reminds me just of him. And by the way, so does Harvey Weinstein. You know, they're abusers. They use their temper. They use their size. They use their erratic behavior to draw attention to them at the expense of other people, which is fine if you're a dude that's sitting in front of your TV watching Fox News. But it's not okay when you're the guy who has control over the nuclear codes and you're engaged in a really stupid Twitter back and forth with a nut in North Korea. That's not okay.
No, it's not okay. Now, here's the thing. I don't know about Harvey Weinstein. What this guy, this psychiatrist was saying is something that I know about narcissistic personality disorder, which is that they suffer stress and anxiety when their grandiosity is not reflected back at them. So in other words, you know, they want to be adulated. You know, they want to have, remember that ridiculous scene when all of his cabinet members were like, oh, you're so terrific, you're so great. That's what they need. And when they don't get it, or when they get criticized, they suffer real psychic stress. I don't know if that's true for Harvey Weinstein. It could be. But I mean, Donald Trump, we have all of these reports that he's losing it when he faces criticism, that he's furious and enraged that he's not getting credit for whatever he thinks he did as far as Houston and Florida in the aftermath of the hurricanes, right? There was one report that he's seething mm-hmm. about the lack of credit. I don't know what he thinks he accomplished, but, you know, this is an important point because I actually don't think we should be stigmatizing mental illness. I try not to say, you know, this guy is crazy, that person is nuts. Sometimes I slip on Twitter, I will admit that, but you know, it's hard to balance these things because I think that there's a compelling public interest in having the conversation, is the commander-in-chief mentally ill?
Right. And by the way, to your point about the ridiculous cabinet meeting, did you see the release, the press release that came out of the White House this week with statements from cabinet members praising Donald Trump? Praising his leadership?
I'll
find that for you. But yeah, it was the craziest press release I have ever seen. It was cabinet, basically members of the cabinet talking about how great he was. Right, just like the cabinet meeting. It was the same exact thing, except in writing.
I wonder if they do this to soothe his, right? We have all these reports also that they are working very hard to contain his outbursts. And I wonder if they do stuff like this to soothe his distress over criticism.
Almost certainly.
You know, so that it'll get picked up by, you know, Fox and Friends, and he can watch it on the TV, how great he is, how his cabinet members love him, and it chills him out a little bit. I wonder if that's like the whole intent. Is he the audience for that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's exactly what it is. I think it is exactly that he's that they have to distract him with this thing over here. Let's look over here what these people are saying about you. So don't worry about what you're, you know, that criticism, because look, they all love you over here. And I mean, how is this different than distracting a 2-year-old from a temper tantrum, right? I don't begrudge 2-year-olds their temper tantrums, because that's developmental.
Yes,
a 70-year-old, right? They're two. A 70-year-old man with his hands on the nuclear codes, on the other hand, I think it is reasonable to ask if we have an issue with mental illness and whether or not there should be action taken. And I don't think that's stigmatizing anything. By the way, my comment about Weinstein just came from being the daughter of a narcissist. And I can tell you that the behavior is not always sexual, right?
Yeah.
If you hear a lot of the descriptions of things, it wasn't just the sexual behavior, it was the rages and the tantrums and the threats and the intimidating physical presence and, you know, those kinds of things. That's what
right.
they do. So,
right.
yeah. But, I mean, I don't know. I'm not a I'm not a licensed mental health professional, but I'm just saying my own experience knowing somebody like that. I can tell you that there's a lot of similarities. How's
Here's
that?
Something that occurred to me. The distress that not only you and I, but a lot of people, progressives, liberals, what have you, are feeling during this Trump regime, when it's one thing after another, I wonder if there's an equivalent to people on the right who believed the nonsense the right-wing media said about Obama. Because Obama was a thoughtful center-left, you know, center-leaning, mm-hmm. Cautious
right.
president. He respected, he was very legalistic. He respected the law to a really almost obsessive degree. They tried to mm-hmm. dot every I. So I'm not saying that there was any real equivalent, but if you were, maybe not so much Fox News, but if you were a big fan of Breitbart, you got your news from, you know, whatever, Gateway Pundit and Breitbart and Drudge, right? Mm-hmm. You would think that this guy was unleashing just a fresh hell every day. And I wonder if it caused the same kind of anxiety.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. I don't know. I mean, I think that there's... I think our anxiety is at least fact-based. I mean,
No, I want to make it very clear that I'm
yeah.
not saying there was any kind of equivalent. Our fact-based anxiety, you know, we're believing, who are we believing to be so anxious? Serious reporters, the New York Times, the Washington Post, Trump's own announcements, right?
Right, our lying eyes.
This is reality-based.
Right.
But if you were to be in that bubble, in that mm-hmm. right-wing bubble, where Obama was instituting Sharia law or communism, or, you know, or Hillary Clinton had was running a child abuse ring out of a pizza place. You know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah.
Yes, it's totally ridiculous, and we laugh at it, but I just wonder if it causes them the same kind of psychic harm. Like, if all of these purveyors of BS on the right, you know, it's a gig, it's a grift, is what it is. If they're really harming their people in a way that they may or may not know.
Yeah, I don't know whether they know it or not, but I'm sure that there's similar, that there is harm, like such as you describe. I mean, there has to be. They were and are kept in a state of perpetual anger. I mean, around here, we basically say that Fox News is toxic for that reason alone. And Fox News would be the least fringy of all the things of all the media, right-wing media that you described. And yet we describe it as toxic because it is meant to make people angry and keep people angry all the time.
And let me add one word. Keep people angry and afraid.
Right. Afraid. Right. It's the other word. Exactly. And so that anxiety translates in their own, minds. They tend to want more, maybe an authoritarian answer to that anxiety. Yes. Yeah.
I'll tell you, it's it hasn't made me less ideological, per se, but Trump has certainly made me appreciate that there is something valuable to competence, to knowing what you're doing. You know, I mean, again, just to go back to the Bush administration, I loathe them so much. Mm-hmm. And yet I never thought that they were going to, like, I always
tread
thought,
the Constitution for starters, you know, get it blown up. Yeah, I mean, I agree. I totally understand what you're saying.
You know, they weren't going to start a Twitter fight with Kim Jong-un. Right, and escalate that into a potential war. Like, they were awful. Iraq was a catastrophe. They were terrible. But there is something to the fact that they had a basic grasp on how government works. Mm-hmm. They didn't think that clean coal was coal that had been washed off. You know, mm-hmm. Trump, the surest thing is that Trump has no idea what that executive order on health care that he signed on Thursday, what it means, what it would do. He has no clue about any of this stuff. He just wants to signal to his base that he's not completely ineffectual.
Right.
Caroli, I believe we are out of time. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today.
Well, thanks for having me.
Folks, stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break and then be right back with David Dan.
It's a rainy afternoon, 1990. The big city. Jeez, it's been 20 years. Candy. You were so fine.
And
Welcome back to the show. I'm pleased to be joined by David Dayan, who writes all over the place. He's a regular contributor to The Intercept, where he wrote this week about a disaster relief package that the House passed and how it amounts to a big middle finger for Puerto Rico, where there are still 3.5 weeks after Hurricane Maria hit, widespread power outages. There's shortages of drinking water, fuel, and food, and complaints that FEMA is nowhere to be found. There was also a story in Vox this week suggesting that the official death count, which is currently at 45, may be hundreds short. And it appears, you know, it can be difficult to attribute a cause of death to the hurricane. It appears that the government, for whatever reason, is being much more conservative about the fatalities that they're attributing to Maria than they have been in the hurricanes in Texas and Florida. David's piece, if you want to read it, is titled Puerto Rico Relief Bill Cancels $16 billion in Debt, but Not for Puerto Rico. David, welcome back to Politics and Reality Radio.
Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for taking the time. Now, before this storm hit, Puerto Rico was dealing with a debt crisis caused primarily by people on the mainland. The island's existing debt was around $74 billion. Again, this is before the storm hit, and its GDP is only around $100 billion. I think you've written about this before, and it's not a simple story, but do you think you could give the kind of two-minute version of this background, because it is important?
Sure. Well, Puerto Rico has been in the midst of an economic depression for over a decade. And the reason for that is a number of different decisions made by our government. Puerto Rico is a territory, some would say a colony, and is very reliant on decisions made by Congress. In 1996, Congress decided to take away a large manufacturing benefit for Puerto Rico. And once that fully phased out in 2006, the Puerto Rican economy has been in depression ever since. And there are a variety of other factors in that. But essentially what happened is the successive governments on the island decided to paper over this problem of economic depression by borrowing. And they were forced into borrowing by Wall Street investors who knew that those bonds would be very tax preferenced. They are actually exempt from state, local, and federal taxes. And so this debt problem kind of spiraled. A lot of these loans were predatory, and it led to Puerto Rico being put in a situation where all these loans were unpayable, as they said 2 years ago. And right now we have a situation where there's $74 billion in debt. There are various creditors, including hedge funds, who scooped up these bonds at a severe discount, pennies on the dollar, and are looking to force a full repayment in order to try to repay. Puerto Rico has gone through massive waves of austerity. They've cut the government budget severely. They've slacked on maintenance and upkeep of critical services, which was a major factor in the hurricane because the electric grid was completely fragile and brittle. In fact, about 65% of the island had blackouts before the hurricanes this summer.
So before the hurricane struck.
Yes. So
and you wrote a few weeks ago, you wrote another piece where you called around to their creditors and said, hey, they just got flattened by this hurricane. Are you willing to forgive some of this debt? And they said, well, we'll give them additional loans.
Yes. The a certain class of bondholders, the actual bondholders for money for the electric grid, PREPA, the Puerto Rican Electric Power Authority, offered a loan. And I should note that Puerto Rico rejected that loan. They said, we don't want to go into more debt. That's not our idea. But in the current situation, the big problem for the Puerto Rican government is what you would call liquidity. They have not been able to collect taxes for the last month since the hurricane struck because, you know, the communications and basic infrastructure of the island has been devastated. So It takes a certain amount of money to run the government, and Puerto Rico didn't exactly have a large reserve. So officials have estimated that by October 31st, Puerto Rico would run out of money and basically have to shut down the government.
Jesus. So, okay, this is U.S. territory. It's been flattened. Businesses are shuttered. Obviously, there's no tourists on the island at this point. Tax revenues are zero. So they're not only neck deep in debt that pre-existed this hurricane, they're struggling to keep the local government open even as they face the decimation from this hurricane. And Donald Trump is tweeting about how they're ingrates. This is all their fault, and saying FEMA and the military can't stay there forever. Tell us about the relief bill that congressional Republicans are offering in the midst of this incredible crisis facing American citizens in Puerto Rico.
Right. So Puerto Rico obviously appealed for help. They said, look, we need some cash here to keep the government lights on in the very near term. We need it right away. And so what both Donald Trump and congressional Republicans fashioned is a bill that provides that support for ongoing government operations, but it does it in the form of a loan. It's a $5 billion loan that Puerto Rico would obviously have to pay back on top of the $774 billion that they already are in arrears on to private creditors. So this would be a loan from the U.S. Treasury. Would probably be first in line above the private creditors, but they would have to pay it back, and they would have to pay it back with interest. You know, we've had lots of hurricanes and natural disasters this summer. There is no other instance of any, you know, support for or relief being delivered in the form of a loan.
Right. So in Texas and Florida, it was the largesse of the American government, and there was no suggestion that we would just float them a loan to get them through the crisis.
Exactly.
Now, wait a second, because the bill does cancel $16 billion in debt.
Right.
So who's getting the bailout?
The bailout goes to the National Flood Insurance Program. Now, the Flood Insurance Program, the way it works is people pay premiums if they live in a place that is designated as liable to flooding, and then the flood insurance program pays out. But of course, because we allow people to build in floodplains and places that are extremely dangerous for building, the flood insurance program has been in debt for a long time. And what they can do is they can get a loan from the U.S. Treasury, sort of a line of credit to pay off those claims when they come in. That's capped at a $30 billion line of credit. And after Harvey and Irma, the flood insurance program had basically reached this limit. So they were going to run out of being able to pay any claims. So what they do in this bill is they cancel $16 billion of that debt. So the flood insurance program doesn't have to repay the government. And it's just this cruel irony that you have this island that is terribly $74 billion in debt. And what we give them, you know, there are grants in the bill that don't necessarily all go to Puerto Rico, but they might go to Puerto Rico. But there's also this big $5 billion loan. And at the same time, there's debt relief in the bill, but it goes to the flood insurance program, and it doesn't make any changes to that program. So people are still incentivized to build in these floodplains. A complete waste of money, literally throwing government money in the ocean, and we do nothing about it.
Lordy, lordy. We just have a government run by completely inept jackasses who seem to lack even the most minimal human empathy. And here we have an island. I've been to Puerto Rico a number of times when I was young. I used to live down in the Caribbean. And these people are just suffering so badly.
And let me just say, Joshua, this is a bipartisan problem, right? The bill passed the House this week. 189 Democrats, everyone who voted on it, voted yes.
Yes.
And this is just sort of seen as the way it is. If you have a liquidity problem, You can't pay your bills right away. This is what we do. We give you a bridge loan. We just, you know, it's...
Well, if you're Puerto Rico.
If you're Puerto Rico, yeah, we give you a bridge loan. And there's just no concept about how obscene this is, how predatory this is, that you're taking a territory that's in this massive amount of debt and has, and every dollar that you put them more into debt is a dollar you're taking out of the hands of an American citizen that is suffering for more than a decade with a terrible austerity crisis. This is America's Greece, right? And,
yes.
And you're just putting them back into this again, and absolutely nobody of either party has stepped up and said that this is wrong. I mean, even the most vociferous defenders of Puerto Rico, people like Luis Gutierrez and Nydia Velasquez, they voted for this bill and they did not raise any concern over the fact that we were giving them a loan to manage their ongoing operations.
Well, there were 60-something Republicans who voted against it because even this
right.
was too much largesse for Puerto Rico. David, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to join us. I believe we are out of time.
Okay. Thank you.
Folks, read David's piece. It's at The Intercept. It makes your blood boil. It's called Puerto Rico Relief Bill Cancels $16 billion in Debt, but Not for Puerto Rico. David, Dan, thank you again.
Okay. Thank you.
I'd also like to thank Austin Fracht and Carol Lee Coons. You can follow me on Twitter at Joshua Hall. You can write an email griping about the show to politicsandreality@gmail.com. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes or Podbean or SoundCloud or wherever else you can find it. I'd also like to thank the good people at Crooks and Liars, including Caroli, the Smirking Chimp, and Hullabaloo, that's Digby, for letting me host the show at their respective joints. Of course, I want to thank all of you fine people for tuning in. Have a terrific week.
There's no way if I crawl, if I could crawl.